Hello, this is KOWS 107.3 in Occidental. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Robert Shulman. Today I'm very fortunate to have a special guest in the studio, Dr. Ben Asher from New York City. Dr. Asher is a holistic ear, nose, and throat doctor, and we'll be talking about all things ear, nose, and throat this morning. If you're listening, we will be taking calls. If you have a pen, the station number is 707-874-1073. That's 707-874-1073. And I'll let you know when we're taking calls. Good morning, Ben.
Morning, Robert. Nice to see you today.
Let's see. Can I hear you? Say something again. Make sure.
Can you hear me speaking now?
I got to speak a
little. Do you want to speak more into the microphone?
Yeah, a little
bit closer. So you can hear me like this?
There you go. Okay.
How's that?
Perfect.
Great.
So I'm so glad to have you in the studio this morning. And tell me a little bit about, some people don't, you know, when you say the word ear, nose, and throat doctor, some people have no idea what that means. And especially when you say otolaryngologist, and one of my favorite words, the otolaryngoscope.
Otolaryngoscope?
Otolaryngoscope, yeah.
I'm not sure I've ever heard of that instrument. But so let me just tell you one, take one step back and just tell you a little bit about myself. For people that don't know, I know you know me. I practice in New York City. My practice is right in the heart of Midtown Manhattan on 57th and 7th.
There we go.
And I see a wide array of ENT issues. I've been practicing for over 30 years, and I've been a holistic integrative doctor for that amount of time. What ear, nose, and throat doctors do, or otolaryngologists, is basically treat all diseases of the head and neck except for the brain and the eyes. Pretty much. It used to be the field was American Board of Ophthalmology and Otolaryngology, and we people used to see it was an eye, ear, nose, throat doctor. But the eye was dropped a long time ago. So that's pretty much what I do. Otolaryngologists are surgeons by training, and the field of ENT surgery is quite broad. And about 12 years ago, when I moved to New York City from being on the faculty of Dartmouth Medical School, I gave up surgery because I really felt it was important to try to keep people out of the operating room as best as I possibly could. So we take care of allergies. We take care of pediatric ENT issues like ear infections and tonsillitis, sinus disease, voice disorders, throat issues, head and neck cancer, thyroid disease. So it's quite a broad array of things that ENTs do. Now, I'm holistic and integrative, and I actually take care of the whole person, so I do more than what most ENTs do. I do some GI medicine, and that's gastroenterology, so I'll take care of some patients with irritable bowel issues and intestinal parasites and reflux disease. And now, and we probably won't touch on this, but about 40% of my practice is Lyme disease.
Wow. So you find that people who come in with problems that a conventional ear, nose, and throat doctor might attribute only to their ear, nose, and throat, that you find that those actually are more systemic and require a more integrative approach to treatment.
That's right. I think that one of the biggest flaws in our Western medical model is the total compartmentalization of the body, and the idea that problems that occur in the ENT region are not related to some other part of the body is erroneous. And you can't just treat the ear, nose, and throat part of a person without saying, geez, what's going on with all the rest of you?
Robin Williams had a great line about that in a comedy sketch where he said that everybody knows why insurance doesn't cover your teeth and your eyes, because they're not part of your body. So I think there's probably a similarity there.
Right. So just as an example on that side of things, I see a lot of patients with chronic sinusitis and recurrent sinusitis, and they are a little bit different in terms of what they are. And I'm not talking about sinus headaches. Sinus headaches are a completely different animal in terms of problems. But people that are getting recurrent sinus infections, they get upper respiratory infections, and then they get a sinus infection on top of that over and over again, yellow drainage from their nose, they can't stop coughing, they got facial pain and pressure, and that happens every time they get a cold. So the difference between what a conventional ENT would do and I do about this is conventional ENTs will treat you with antibiotics, and then they may give you some nasal steroid sprays to reduce the inflammation of your nose. I ask the question, geez, why is it that a person is having this problem? Why is it coming back all the time? Often you'll hear the story that a person has had they get an upper respiratory infection, and then they're put on an antibiotic. They never had recurrent sinus infections before, but somebody decided they had a sinusitis. They put them on an antibiotic. The antibiotic happened, and then they get over it. But shortly after being on that course of antibiotics, they get sick again. Then they get on another course of antibiotics, and they get sick again. So the question here is, what could those antibiotics be doing to the person that might be making them get recurrently sick? And what they do is they destroy your microbiome. They destroy the bacteria in your gut, and they allow yeast to grow. And the yeast occupies a part of your gut flora, which is important if there are other organisms growing there that your body needs that are involved in your immune function. So when those are destroyed and then the yeast is growing, your immune system is depleted.
So it sounds like you're implying that the very first insult, if you will, is the course of antibiotics that kind of set things on an awkward pathway.
That's right. So then the person now has yeast in their gut and they're getting sick all the time. And this is something that we integrative doctors have been saying for the beginning of time, that what bacteria are growing in your gut are really important for your immune system. And people are just beginning to start to understand that. And they are starting to listen, and they're starting to unwind the incredible complexity. But there is evidence in animal models that the lactobacillus species occupies a certain part of the gut flora that is really important in immune modulation. And yeast actually will occupy the same biological niche. So if the lactobacillus isn't there, there's having some problem with the immune modulation. And I would say in about 80% of my patients with recurrent sinusitis, if you treat them for yeast issues, whether you use anti-yeast medicines or you use anti-yeast herbs, those patients get a lot better, will be almost cured of getting recurrent sinus infection.
And what's the role of diet there? Do you put people on no yeast, no mold diets? Do you get them off sugar? How do you sort of direct their diet to improve the microbiome?
Well, that's a good question, and I think a controversial one. It depends on what I do. If I put a person on a anti-yeast medicine, a strong one like Nystatin or Diflucan, I feel like that pretty much gets rid of yeast. And I don't think that there is the bread mold or something else, you know, the yeast that's in bread, and that's not the same yeast that is Candida albicans, although there is some cross-reactivity, and people say that causes some problems. So I'm not that strict. I just tell people to stay off refined carbohydrates and sugar. That's just my how I work. Other people are much more strict.
I see.
If I'm doing an herbal approach, so taking one of the anti-yeast herbs like caprylic acid, oregano oil, pal-darco, and things like that, I am much more strict because those aren't quite as potent as the medicines. And I will say that the medicines have their side effects. I've had both Nystatin causes a lot of abdominal pain in some people, and Diflucan has an unusual side effect, I think, of making people feel depressed. Now, it may be a die-off reaction, but I've had a number of people feel depressed on Diflucan, and if that's the case, I don't use it in them.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that those people who have recurrent sinusitis or frequent sinus infections tend to more likely be smokers or have a poor diet to begin with?
Can be, absolutely. I mean, smoking is a major hit to your respiratory tract. It kills all the little finger-like projections on the lining of your nose that push the mucus around, and it causes a lot of what's called stasis of mucus, so that doesn't flow. It then gets trapped in your sinuses, which is a perfect media for bacteria to grow in, and then that's how you get a sinus infection if you're a smoker. Definitely, high sugar diets are not healthy. There's evidence out there that sugar suppresses the immune system, and people that are eating just lots of garbage makes a big difference in terms of how they feel. Now, a lot of people get away with it. There are people out there that smoke cigarettes and live to be 110 years old. But I wouldn't point that to that person and assume that that's what's going to happen to you if you smoke.
Mm-hmm. Do you find the same difficulty with electronic cigarettes, with vaporizing tobacco? Is that something that's come up?
That actually isn't a big part of my practice. Mm-hmm. It's surprising how few of my patients smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I would say less than 5% of the people that come see me smoke. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly that I have a self-select group of people who are interested in the kind of medicine that I practice. And they're already at a different kind of level of what they want in terms of their health. They've already given up the cigarettes.
I see. So they're already coming to you sort of primed for wanting to have a holistic approach.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes it a little easier.
It does make it a little easier.
Yeah. I've recently come across some patients who drink a prodigious amount of soda, several liters a day, which is sort of startling. But you know, you go to the grocery store, somebody's buying it and drinking it because the shelves are fully stocked with it. So.
Right. Well, you know, Mayor Bloomberg in New York was trying to get rid of the big gulp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's too bad that failed. I think that it's hard to be a nanny, though. It's hard for the government to be a nanny about food. But as we know, the sugar industry is pretty powerful, as powerful or more powerful than the tobacco industry and lobby. So
I want to circle back on something which I think is another important piece, which you as a in your area of physical medicine and rehabilitation in terms of headaches, because the sinus headache is a big part of what I have to re-educate people about. Because sinus headaches have nothing to do with the sinuses.
Thank you.
Zero. You can, if you have an acute sinusitis and you have some sinus pain, that's one thing. But people who come in and say, oh, my sinus, I have sinus headaches, that is a musculoskeletal problem or a migraine variant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of medical literature about that talks about that particular fact, but it's kind of buried.
Mm-hmm.
And in the world of primary care, people don't understand that piece. So if you go to your primary care doctor complaining of a sinus headache, they're likely going to put you on an antibiotic. Now, here's what happens. Antibiotics not only kill bacteria, but they also work like anti-inflammatory agents. So they work like taking an Advil or an Aleve or a Tylenol, and they reduce inflammation. And if you have inflammation from what are called trigger points, which are areas of inflammation in muscles that refer pain to another location. So if you have pain in a trigger point in your neck, it refers pain to your forehead. That trigger point will be inactivated from the antibiotics, and you'll think that, oh, I took the antibiotics, I have an infection, it makes the headache go away. So it keeps on reinforcing the antibiotic consumption for these headaches. But all the antibiotics are doing here is an anti-inflammatory and messing up your gut and causing these people are the people then really go on to get sinus infections because their gut's been so destroyed.
Because they end up getting the fungal infections,
right,
as
exactly.
Well. And it's not a trivial point. I know when my practice was in New York City, I took care of an individual who had been told that he had sinus infections and was placed on multiple courses of the class of antibiotics called fluoroquinolones. I don't remember if it was Floxin or Levaquin or what have you, and he ruptured both his Achilles tendon and his rotator cuff, and he was naturally a little dismayed to find out that one, those ruptures had been caused by the antibiotics. He hadn't been apprised of that, and two, that he never had sinus infections to begin with. What he had were migraines, and we treated him for that much in the same way, using release of the tension in his neck and shoulders, and he ultimately did quite well. But it is an important thing. It's disturbing. I know that you do an amazing thing in your office, which I've been fortunate to experience, where you do a myofascial release. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you do and how you learned it? And it's really a wonderful experience.
Well, about 20 years ago, I took my son to an osteopath when he was 6 months old because he was having recurrent ear infections and was going to need to have ear tubes. And actually, at the time, my wife absolutely did not want my son to get ear tubes, nor did I. But she said, we really have to. There was a very famous osteopath in Seattle we took him to. And she not only treated his ears, but he had had an abnormal crawl. So he crawled with his right leg whipped around in a very funny way, and we mentioned it to our pediatrician, and he said, oh, well, he'll grow out of it. Everybody crawls differently. Well, the doctor, who actually now practices around, she's practicing here in Santa Rosa, Margaret Sorrell, said, well, he had some restrictions in his sacral area, and I fixed those while I was working on him, and I put him on the floor. And he crawled absolutely normally after that.
And his ears?
Ears cleared up, and he didn't need tubes. So that was like, oh, my God, I have to learn this.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Sorrell recommended that I take a course, and then she was kind enough to let me mentor with her for 2 years. I would come to her office a half a day a week.
Uh-huh.
And then she told me, put your hands on everybody that comes in your office if you really want to do hands-on work. And that's what I did. And then I've extended what I've learned. The work of Janet Travell sort of came before me, and I looked at the trigger point pictures, and it was of how these pain patterns that I was seeing in my people in my office with these pain patterns, and I saw how they related to trigger points. I said, wow, that's pretty amazing. And because I was already doing hands-on work, I was just working with releasing trigger points with my hands. And now I've treated probably 10,000 people.
Wow.
And, you know, I have quite educated hands now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I still have fond memories of experiencing your educated hands in your office. And are you still using the hot rocks as well as
Them. Uh-huh. I do use them sometimes. I now have people laying on a biomat, which is a far infrared heat mat.
Uh-huh.
So people are just laying on that and they get the heat from that.
Uh-huh.
And then sometimes I use the rocks.
And is that one of those amethyst far infrared?
Yes, it's an amethyst. Uh-huh. Amethyst.
Yeah. Oh, and you like that?
I do.
Oh, uh-huh.
I also have a far infrared sauna actually in my office that people. I have people get in for various reasons. One is it's amazing if you're getting sick in terms of not getting sick, stopping a cold from happening. It's great for people that have Lyme disease. It's great for detoxification. So far infrared saunas are really a great adjunct to healing.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So a far infrared sauna is not as hot as a conventional sauna, correct?
That is correct.
Uh-huh.
My sauna probably only goes up to about 120 degrees, 123 degrees. I have a full spectrum sauna, so it goes through a cycle of far, near, and mid-infrared. The infrared heat is very penetrating without getting so hot. You get the benefit of the heat without the discomfort of being too hot. You perspire some. It's not an enormous amount. The experience is that of like sitting on a beach, feeling the warm sun on you. And there is actually literature from Japan talking about far infrared saunas for congestive heart failure. It stimulates circulation in the microcirculation and gets it back into the vascular spaces, and it's really good for the heart. And the deep penetration just allows for cellular detoxification.
Huh, nice. And so, are people? Is it? Do they need to take a shower afterwards?
No, actually not.
Right back
you can just wipe yourself off and get back to work. It doesn't really mess anything up. Your hair, you're not like you've run the marathon or anything like that.
Nice. So people come in during the day.
I have a lot of performers in my practice, and they feel like they're coming in. They're coming down with a cold, or they're just really tired. Their voice is tired, and I'll have them come be in the sauna. And another piece on that, on the performer side of things, I take care of an awful lot of vocalists. And a discovery that I made about 6 or 7 years ago at this point, maybe 6 years ago, is that the antioxidant glutathione, which is the most potent antioxidant the body makes, and we all need antioxidants because we live in an oxygen environment, and oxygen is toxic to us. It produces what are called free radicals, which are unstable molecules with a free electron, which is unhappy unless it's grabbed something, and it usually takes a piece of you.
Mm-hmm.
So the body says, I don't want that, and we have antioxidants that are created within us. And the number one mother of all antioxidants is glutathione. And glutathione works as in two different ways. It works in the liver for detoxification. So if you take a Tylenol, your body has to get rid of the Tylenol, and the glutathione help binds the Tylenol and gets rid of it. Also, it works as an antioxidant. The voice box is full of glutathione. And a discovery that I made is that high doses of glutathione is really God's gift to the voice.
Oh, wow.
And I use it in my vocalists. I have a lot of high-level performers, and it is an absolutely extraordinary thing. I've seen it reverse vocal polyps and nodules, improve them. I've used it in a lot of performers. Instead of, if they went to a conventional ENT, they would get steroids, which have a lot of bad side effects. The glutathione will often help enormously for vocal fatigue. It improves vocal range. It's a great thing, and it really feels good. It's also good for your immune system and improves your immune function too.
And so are we talking about intravenous glutathione here?
I give it intravenously, but there are oral preparations. They have liposomalized the glutathione so that it doesn't get destroyed in the stomach. And there are several really good products out there. I don't know whether I'm allowed to mention them.
You could probably say it's probably best to leave that
so
out.
So I will leave it out. There are good products that you do get some absorption. And if you're a performer, taking it on a regular basis, I think, is a great thing. And then if you're really performing extra hard, finding somebody who can give it to you intravenously once in a while would be helpful, too.
And what about glutathione precursors like N-acetylcysteine? Do you then encourage people to use those as well?
I often do because it's helpful to have levels of NAC. Part of the issue with NAC is the person really converting the NAC into the glutathione.
And do you ever measure levels like intracellular glutathione or anything like that, or are you just pretty much going clinically by the effectiveness of it?
Well, unfortunately, New York State does not allow that test.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I've been out of New York long enough to know that that New York's sort of restrictive in some of the integrative testing that can be done. We're going to take a moment, a break for a moment for a announcement. Cows Radio thanks our neighbors, the Bohemian Market, for supporting community radio. The Bohemian Market features an all-organic produce section, a full-service deli and meat counter. In addition, you'll find a coffee bar and a wide selection of beer and wines. You'll find them open daily until 9 at 633 Main Street, right in downtown Occidental. They can be reached by phone at 874-3312. All right, we're back with our special guest, Dr. Ben Asher from New York City. The name of the show is To Your Health, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Shulman. We've been talking about Dr. Asher's integrative approaches to ear, nose, and throat medicine, rather. And anyone listening would like to call in, the number is 707-874-1073, 707-874-1073. So
I would like to touch on something that you had mentioned that you it's a little bit of a black hole, but the Lyme disease piece. And there's a reason why, because I'm seeing a lot of signs as I've been driving around here with Lyme disease is endemic to a lot of this area.
We have a lot of ticks here.
One of the things, this is the thing that got me into treating Lyme disease is actually vertigo. Because there is a condition in the ENT world called Meniere's syndrome. And Meniere's syndrome is a triad of three things. Episodic vertigo, which is severe, incapacitating, lasting anywhere from 20 minutes to 18 hours. Roaring, ringing in your ear, and fluctuating hearing loss. And I was seeing a number of those patients. And one of my patients that I had seen had had a fixed hearing loss for 6 years. In one of his ears, he absolutely had no serviceable hearing in it. And he was having such severe Meniere's spells that he couldn't find his way home. He had such bad Meniere's as well as having terrible brain fog. And he had told me that he had had Lyme disease 6 or 8 years ago, and then shortly, and a few years after that, he was diagnosed with Meniere's. Now, Lyme disease is a spirochete, very similar to syphilis. And one of the One of the things of late-stage syphilis is also Meniere-like syndrome. So I thought, well, geez, maybe this gentleman might have Meniere, it might be Lyme disease related to his ears. So I put him on antibiotics. And lo and behold, after a month of antibiotics, a almost completely dead ear came back to life, and he had serviceable hearing in the ear, which is really, in the world of ENT, that's like a miracle. Really, that's just not even, they would tell you, once you've lost your hearing in a Meniere's ear, that's it. There's nothing more to do.
And we're talking about something that had been documented by a otolaryngologist, a specialist in hearing.
Me too. Mm-hmm. And I'd gotten the hearing tests and was like, yeah, this is what's going on. Right. And so it was like, I had his previous audiograms, his hearing tests, I'd shown, it was, and really, for a six-year fixed hearing loss is unbelievable. Mm. And it came back. And I've had that happen on a number of patients now. And so what I do with all of my patients now that are diagnosed with Meniere syndrome is I treat them for Lyme disease, even if the Lyme testing is negative, because the Lyme testing is not an adequate test. It's actually very poor. I'd like to call it Lyme disease, but I can't in those situations. So I call it doxycycline responsive sensory neural hearing loss, because it is amazing to see. Uh-huh. I've had this happen on enough occasions where it's quite extraordinary.
And how long do you have to keep them on the doxycycline for?
I usually treat people for a couple months. Uh-huh. The result comes back, the hearing comes back after about a month. And then it will, you can take somebody off the doxycycline and their hearing will remain stable. But a lot of the fluctuating hearing disorders, the dizziness issues, the symptom of, like, there's a condition called mal de débarquement where you feel like you're on a boat all the time, I believe are Lyme related. And it's just important because the ENT world doesn't know anything about it. And they, the ENT literature says that, yes, hearing loss is associated with Lyme disease, but treating the Lyme disease does not improve the hearing. And there's a reason why that the literature is that way, is that anybody that's ever been diagnosed with Lyme and hearing loss, they've only been treated for 10 days of doxycycline, because that's kind of the standard of care, and they're not getting a complete treatment. So I want this to be out there for people to know that they should be asking their doctor, and their doctor may say, no, this can't possibly be Lyme disease, in which case then I think you should go to what's called a Lyme-literate doctor, doctors who are treating Lyme in a little bit more dynamic, creative way, and are interested and believe in long-term antibiotics. There's an organization called ILADS where you can get the information of where a Lyme-literate doctor is in your community.
But you're using oral doxycycline. You're not necessarily using intravenous Rocephin or any of those type of more aggressive antibiotic approaches.
I do not do any intravenous antibiotics out of my office. If somebody needs that, I refer them to somebody else. I've seen the benefit also happen with oral amoxicillin. It doesn't have to be doxycycline if you're doxycycline allergic. But it definitely is a very important piece for people that are struggling with Meniere's. And I just think it's worth treating, even if you've had Meniere's for a very long time, it's worth doing a month or two of doxycycline just to see if it makes a difference in stopping your condition.
Well, this it's fascinating, and it's time now for a public service announcement. And just by coincidence, the one that's on the top of the page is regarding the risk of Lyme disease transmission. And the title of the announcement is, the risk of Lyme disease transmission is year-round in Marin and Sonoma counties. The Marin-Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control District wants to remind outdoor enthusiasts that adult ticks are most active from fall through early spring, while the tiny nymphs, you actually can't see those, are most active in the spring and early summer. Both stages can transmit the bacterium that causes Lyme disease. The advice is to take personal protection measures before, during, and after being in tick habitats, no matter what time of year it is. And here are some of the additional suggestions for avoiding tick bites. Wear light-colored clothing with long sleeves and long pants. pre-treat clothing and equipment with permethrin to kill ticks, apply repellent containing DEET on exposed skin, showering after being in tick habitat helps detect ticks, remove ticks promptly using correct techniques, and contact your physician if you have concerns or become ill after being bitten by a tick. So, I think just since we're on All Things Lyme, we don't want to scare listeners into thinking that if they find a tick on them, that they will immediately have Lyme disease. And in fact, my experience and my understanding of the literature is that if you find the tick and it's not particularly engorged, it really takes about 24 hours for the infection. No, you're nodding your head no. So the conventional wisdom is that if you find the tick and it's on you, it takes about 24 hours for the Lyme spirochete, for the bacteria, to go from the tick's body into your bloodstream. But I see you smiling. So
this is my understanding of the of the literature on that particular subject is that the ticks that have been used to determine the amount of time it takes for the Lyme, for the spirochete to get into you, are actually laboratory ticks. Mm. They're not ticks that are in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And they have actually looked at other ticks and seen that the transmission can actually be quite rapid.
Mm.
So it can be in under 24 hours. It really depends on where the organism is in the tick at the time it bites you.
Mm-hmm.
My general rule is anybody that has been bit by a tick, by a deer tick, not a brown dog tick, mm-hmm. but a deer tick, because you really don't know how long it's been on you, is to treat yourself with a 10-day to 2-week course of an antibiotic.
Mm.
And in the Lyme endemic areas in upstate New York, where it's just everybody's gotten bit by a tick, if you walk in the door with a tick in your hand, they give you an antibiotic for 2 weeks. They don't really, it's just not worth it to have the risk of having a chronic problem.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue there, of course, is that the tiny little nymph ticks, which are just bigger than the size of a pinhead, and the public service announcement just mentioned that those ticks are more common in the spring and early summer. Of course, around here, once the weather gets dry, we don't really see as many ticks. But the problem is that one wouldn't know that a lymph tick was on their body.
Right. So the risk, then at that point in time, well, you can't do, I mean, I don't think people should chronically be on antibiotics.
Right.
So, but if you don't know, then you don't know. But I'm just saying if you find the tick, then you take the antibiotic. If for some reason you have a febrile illness, which isn't, you know, you could have a bad flu-like illness that is way outside of flu season, then I would probably take an antibiotic for Lyme disease at that point in time.
So fever, chills, body
right,
aches.
Right, joint pains, mm-hmm. anything like that. I wouldn't mess around. The ticks in the East, and I'm sure that they are also here, are also infected with other organisms, which will cause other illnesses. But Ehrlichia, which will also give you that type of febrile illness, is responsive to doxycycline. So you're going to treat both with doxycycline.
Hmm. So you're testing for the co-infections and that can accompany the spirochete, the Lyme spirochete in the ticks.
Right. I mean, these ticks are called nature's dirty needles.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, they're not they're not very popular. they probably serve some role in nature, sort of like the mosquito and the Zika virus right now, which has us all kind of, it's the next thing we should be
paranoid
terrified
about. Right,
right exactly. Well, let's move along to something maybe a little less scary. How about sore throats? So everybody gets a sore throat in the winter. Nobody likes it. If you end up at a walk-in clinic or an urgent care, you might get a Z-Pak. Even without a throat culture, and as we discussed, too frequent use of antibiotics can create yeast and all that. And so what's your approach? What should the listener think about when they have their, you know, maybe every winter they get a sore throat or whatever, and what are the danger signs when someone might want to make sure they go to the doctor?
That's a good question. So generally speaking, I don't treat sore throat tonsillitis with an antibiotic unless it's positive for strep. And the reason for treating tonsillitis that's positive for strep with an antibiotic is because of the risk of a complication of the strep, not really because you're trying to get rid of the strep faster. So a strep throat can cause, still there's rheumatic fever out there. You can get post, what's called post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, which is a problem with the kidneys. And for that reason, you treat a strep throat with antibiotics. So I still do that. If I have rapid strep tests, I have a very good rapid strep test, and I consider it as good as a culture. So that's what I use. But with the, if it's a strep negative tonsillitis or throat, I don't use antibiotics at all. So the question is, what natural products are there out there that can be used for upper respiratory infections and sore throats and the general crud that everybody comes down with? So there are several, I use several different products that are really helpful. The first thing is to try not to get sick. And there is a product called activated hexose correlated compound, which is a mushroom derivative. It comes in different forms. I don't know what I'm allowed to say online.
You can probably say I wouldn't say that the name of a particular brand, but we can discuss the products in general.
Okay, so a product, there are several different brands that carry this Japanese patented mushroom product, which if you go online and you look in the Medline search for this particular compound, you'll see lots of immune boosting properties.
And say the name of it again,
activated
please.
Activated hexose correlated compound, AHCC.
AHCC, activated hexose correlated compound. That's a tongue twister there.
Right. So, but it's under, if you just go AHCC, you'll see what it is. And I tell people generally everybody should be taking one, taking that every day to prevent getting sick. Now you can bump up the amount if you are sick. There is another product, which is a Canadian product, which is a proprietary North American ginseng. And that product has been shown not only to prevent upper respiratory infections and the flu, but in the course of a flu, it's been shown, and colds, it's been shown to reduce the duration of symptoms. I think that that product is available mostly on the internet. It's hard to find that in stores.
Would another product, any sort of American ginseng, likely be as effective?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. Probably it would. But they have some proprietary extract of the ginseng. Then I particularly like Chinese herbal products containing yin chao. Which you can tell me more about
love yin chao. So when I went to herb school in the late 90s, our herb school instructor Helen Zhang, who had trained in, she was actually a gynecologist who became an herbalist, went back to Beijing to study herbs and got a PhD in herbs, came back to the United States and worked as an acupuncturist herbalist. She always told us, use the top 10 famous formulas for start, and yin chao is in that group, and it's a wonderful has anti-inflammatory properties, clear, what in Chinese herbal medicine we call clear heat properties. Curiously, what I found when I use Chinese herbs is that one needs to use different formulas during the course of the infection to treat different aspects, which makes it a little bit more complicated. But for example, if you have a runny nose, you're using Beyond Pion. If it's a sore throat part of the cold, you're using Yin Chao. If you have more of a feverish aches and chills and it's becoming more of a fluish thing, there's something called Zan Gan Ling. So you have to sort of mix and match, which is a little tricky when we've all grown up with thinking that it's the Z-Pak that's going to make us better and we only need to do one thing. So it's really the more motivated and well informed the individual with the sore throat is, I think the easier it is to use those multiple products. But it does take a little bit of effort.
Well, like the Yin Chao product, I use it in an Isatis formula, which is a combination formula. But there's a Yin Chao product which doesn't go by the name of Yin Chow, that's available in Whole Foods. And it works very, very well. So I tell people, I mean, I there's a pharmacy in New York that carries everything that I like. So I know I have things that I tell people to get, but there are things that if you're not near that pharmacy and you don't, and your doc, you don't have a doctor that carries products to sell, you can get some good products at Whole Foods. Another another herbal formula that's antiviral is lomatium. Now, different forms of that, I understand that if you take some forms of lomatium, too much of it, it can cause a skin rash. The form that I use, whatever that thing is, not in it, so I don't have that risk in the product that I use.
So you're not using just, I know that there's one of the big distributors, Herb Farm, makes a lomatium product. So it's just a tincture.
Yeah, I don't use that. There's another one that I use that seems to be totally safe, and you don't have any problem. You can use it acutely for a brief period of time. You just don't want to be on it chronically. Some of the people with tick-borne problems will take lomatium for a long time, and if you get the wrong kind,
then they end up getting the rash from it.
You get the rash from So other things that are really amazing for upper respiratory infections, there's a herb called Pelargonium sedoides, which is in a number of off-the-shelf products that you can get at Whole Foods. And it has been shown to be incredibly effective for bronchitis and sinusitis. So taking that product, I tell people to double the dose on the box. It's very effective.
So mention the name. That's kind of a big word there. Okay. Mention that again.
Pelargonium, P-E-L-A-R-G-O-N-I-U-M, sedoides, S-I-D-O-I-D-E-S. It is really an amazing product, and I recommend it to everybody who's getting sick. Then there's there are products that carry humic acid in them, which is also antiviral, which is good to take when you're getting sick. Now, I use that Chinese herbal product Bian Pian for people that are just having, you know, chronic postnasal drip, and it does help a lot of people for that. I've never used it in the acute situation where people are being sick.
Oh, yeah, it works really well for that. It's that first stage where the person has, I had one patient in New York who would come in, and she'd say, my nose is running like a faucet, and it really helps. It helps significantly with that. But you know that, as I'm sure you're aware, that in the Chinese herbal medicine world, a lot of the products are varied. So you might have the sort of basic product, and then various companies mix and match them and change them up a little bit. And of course, historically, the herbs would have been used fresh, raw herbs, and then the herbalist had the opportunity to combine two formulas. So you might have some elements of Yin Chao and some elements of Bian Pian in your herbs that you'd be boiling and drinking the tea.
What's your feeling of wildcrafted American Chinese herbal formulas versus getting herbal formulas from China?
Well, that's an interesting, I think it's a fantastic question. So we actually had as a guest on the show, Peg Schaefer, who grows Chinese herbs down in Sebastopol. And she is now, one of her roles is teaching other people around the United States to grow Chinese herbs. And I do think it's important to get really high quality products. I've been very careful over the years to only use herbs that are made into tablets in the United States or Taiwan, although much of the raw material still comes from mainland China. And we also had Mark Blumenthal, the president of the American Botanical Council, on the show a couple of months back. And we talked about the issue of proper herb identification and the issue that came up with the New York State Attorney General and DNA typing of herbs and how that, all the intricacies of that. So it's not trivial. I think that the sort of pharmaceutical side argument that herbs aren't standardized and you don't know what you're getting and all that, there's an element of truth there that I think people need to be careful, but the law does, as Mark Blumenthal pointed out, the law does require that the distributor is responsible for the integrity of the product. So that the onus is on them, and that's why I tend to stay with just a few companies that I have sought out that I think do what they're supposed to and make sure that the herbs are what they're supposed to be, that there's nothing contaminated in the formula. Mark Blumenthal and I talked about the famous incident of PC Spez. It was a formula that was used for prostate cancer that turned out to be adulterated, and that was only discovered after the formula had been studied and found to be effective for prostate cancer, and it turned out it might not have been the herbs. And so there is a lot there, but I don't think that we need to throw the baby out with the bath in terms of herbs, because there's so much good that can come from them. And but it is a little tricky. On the other side of the coin, I think you and I both see probably far more side effects and adverse reactions to medications than we do from herbs, probably because more people take medication and maybe they're taking them for things that they're already sicker for. But you do need to be careful in that respect as well. So I'm going to take another moment for a public service announcement. Let's see here. This is pretty brief. The announcement is: become a member of the Camp Meeker Volunteer Fire Department. For more information, visit campmeekerfire.org. So you can become a member of the Camp Meeker Volunteer Fire Department, and for more information, visit their website at campmeekerfire.org. You're listening to Your Health, your host, Dr. Robert Shulman. My special guest today is Dr. Ben Asher, a holistic ear, nose, and throat doctor from New York City. And if there's anyone would like to call in, we have a few moments left. The station number is 707-874-1073. So, Ben, one other thing that that people use a lot for sinus and nose problems is the neti pot. And I recall a while back there were some horror stories of people developing infections in their brain from using the neti pot with tap water. Do you think that that's really, like, what's behind all that? And so do you encourage people to use neti pots? And if you do, what type of water do you tell them to use?
Right, I remember that article. I think neti pots or nasal irrigation are really helpful if you're somebody that has bad allergies or has had sinus surgery and you have a sinus cavity that needs to be washed out. I think using large amounts of salt water in the nose oftentimes can be pro-inflammatory, and I often say, you know, we're really not fish and weren't designed to breathe salt water. So it does reduce some inflammation and washes out the lining of the nose. But in many cases, I've seen patients who will, at the beginning of a cold, use a neti pot thinking that they're going to wash something out, when in fact it promotes inflammation, and then they developed a sinus infection from it.
So they're actually making themselves worse.
So right. I generally don't push the neti pot. I like, there are some nasal spray products which I think are really good for cleaning the nose, and I recommend those to people. If there is a real bad problem with nasal crusting or some significant issue, then I'll recommend the neti pot. It's not a pleasant experience. Somebody said it was like sort of being upside down on a sea kayak. So if I don't use the neti pot, there are some other nasal wash systems out there that are particularly good. There are adapters that you can put on a water pick, too, which will really clean out a lot of crusting in the nose. I tell people to use sterile water. They shouldn't just use plain tap water.
So you should boil it.
Yeah, I think that's important. To make sure you get the concentration of salt right. If you don't, you'll be unhappy. There are packets out there that will measure everything and tell you what to do.
So you're really using it in select individuals, right. Not just exactly. Kind of a global thing. Oh, you feel a little sick, you'll neti pot and wash everything away, and actually discouraging people from doing that.
Right. That's what I do.
Wow. So you mentioned, I had had on our little list of things to perhaps discuss, you mentioned that not many of your patients are smokers these days. For the few that you do have who are smoking, how do you encourage them or get them to stop? I know I've had a few patients on Chantix. Some have done quite well, and others have not done well with it. Chantix, for the listener, of course, is a prescription oral medication, and it pretty much makes you lose interest in smoking. And if you try and smoke, you don't feel good. But it doesn't work for everyone. There's also the herb lobelia, which is sort of famous as anti-smoking, but can have side effects, vomiting and so forth. So what's your approach to encouraging people to stop smoking?
I don't use the medical medicines. I'll recommend people get into a behavioral modification program. I think that those probably work the best. Finding, and a lot of those are available through your family practice doctor. So if you go to your family practitioner and you say you want to find or your general practice doctor, you want to find a behavioral modification program for smoke cessation, they're out there. And I know in New York State there's like a smoker cessation hotline you can call, and they'll get you connected up with something. So that's the direction that I usually go for smoking cessation.
And have you seen that be reasonably effective?
I think it works. In a motivated person, once again, somebody has to be motivated to do so.
Yeah, smoking is it's a tough habit to break. And
one thing that I don't do is I don't make people feel terrible. I don't browbeat anybody. So it's a thing. It's an addiction, and it's not easy to break the habit. And people that are stuck on the smoking, I think it's worse for them to be sitting around feeling absolutely hating themselves for doing it, because that emotional state of being is toxic, just like the cigarettes are. So I try not to have people put themselves in a totally negative light. So if somebody's if they cannot quit smoking, then fine, whatever they have to do, that's just the way they're living their lives. But to hate themselves over it is a bad idea.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. It's not pleasant when you go to the doctor because you don't feel well, and the doctor starts blaming you for your illness. That's not why we go to the doctor generally. And you and I were talking before we started the show about the movement in integrative medicine to encourage the person in the patient role to take more responsibility through things such as maybe cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness-based meditation. But many times my experience is the individual might be interested in that, but they might not even be well enough to participate in those things. And so then the trick is to get them well enough through whatever measures so that they can get out and participate in those things, which would be more self-started and so forth. But it can be tricky, particularly when people have chronic illness and chronic pain. It's not so simple as to just, of course, there's that famous Bob Newhart skit, just stop it. I don't know if you remember that one, where the woman comes in and she's afraid of being buried in a box or something. And that's kind of the archetype of it. You know, I think if we could just stop our bad habits, of course we would. And so oftentimes people come to...
this is an interesting point, and I don't think I don't know how much time we have to discuss it, but the difference between healing and curing. People come to a doctor and they're expecting to be fixed. They want their symptom to go away. And there's a broader picture of healing, which is a much deeper phenomenon of a more spiritual awakening, of deep self-acceptance and self-understanding. And that comes from a myriad of avenues and modalities. Nobody has the patent and the only thing that allows people to discover who they really are and to really love themselves in as deeply possible way as they can. And this process of healing happens for some people on their deathbeds, and some people it happens before that, and it depends on how you live your life and what you want. But I believe that part of what the relationship when you go to your doctor is partly about beginning that place of discovery, finding tools that allow you to begin to discover who you are and what that means, and being really truly okay with yourself.
That's a huge, that's a really great way to end our conversation. I think it's an enormous part of understanding how to live our lives, and also to understand our relationships with our healthcare providers. And I think that that's a it's a lifelong process. And I think we all go to the physician or whoever the healthcare provider is expecting to be fixed or treated. And in fact, we call our interactions treatments, and we expect them to treat something. But oftentimes it doesn't happen like that. And so you described it as healing versus cure.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And that's, I mean, you can be a patient with cancer, and you're not cured of your cancer, but be completely healed.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, being completely in a state of presence and in okayness about where you are in your process, even as you're dying, you can be healed into the dying process. And that's a really, that's what I'm in my own medical practice. I'm most interested in sort of trying to find where the portal is, where the doorway is for people to begin to discover that what that means. This is all, it's been going on for many years. I was a meditation teacher before I started medical school, but of recent, I was in the Mayan Peninsula working with this Mayan medicine man, and had some incredibly profound experiences of what this field of healing is all about, and how one can have incredibly profound experience of self-acceptance, self-love, and releasing a lot of ways that one can hold oneself, which is really quite damaging. And it is extraordinary.
Fascinating. Sounds like a topic for another show. And so we're pretty much out of time. Again, I can't thank you enough, Ben, for actually coming in the studio live on your trip out to the Left Coast. You've been listening to KOS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California. The name of the show is To Your Health, your host, Dr. Robert Shulman. And look forward to having you listen again in 2 weeks.
Album with